second part of it is that Russia, as an ally, took the first double veto with China against Western intended aggression towards Syria on 4th of October 2011. Since that time, Russia has taken 17 vetoes against intended Western aggression towards Syria, and China joined Russia in 10 of these vetoes. So this is an ally that you can't trust. Mm-hmm. And then in 2015, as you know, Russia came to the ground with advisors, with Air Force help to the Syrian army to help the Syrian army in fighting terrorism. But all this, if you want, media war against Russia in Syria is to strengthen the enemy, really, and to try and make the people feel that Russia is not trustworthy, that we should not trust Russia. Russia today is fighting a war on behalf of humanity, really, because the war in the Ukraine is, in its truth, is a war between a Western hegemony and between the world that aspires to have its own independent decision and its own integrity. And therefore, Russia, of course, has its own geopolitical needs. And as allies, we understand each other and we agree with each other on any steps. But they did not mention that Russia and the Russian air forces and the Syrian air forces are leading attacks against terrorists in the northeast and the northwest of Syria. They didn't mention the effort Russia is making in order to prevent U.S. allies from partitioning Syria. They don't mention the positive side. We, as Syria, have a trustworthy ally in Russia. Every step, every move is agreed by both, both of us, and there's no problem at all. And just imagine that Syria without allies in the region, or Russia without allies. We need to really solidify our alliance. And I was talking to you off air that the strength of the West is that they get their alliances together, even to do wars and to do wrong things. So we should do our alliances together and strengthen them to do good things, to keep our identity, to keep our independence, to keep our integrity. All the media that tries to plant doubts, either against Russia or against Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many in the Arab media now, they say the problem is not Israel, it's Iran.
Definitely, and this is where I want to end off with the allies of Syria here, because it's no secret that Iran and Hezbollah played a great role alongside the Syrian Arab Army in preventing the Takfiri terrorism from Syria and eliminating also from Iraq and Lebanon. But they're also being blamed in the Western mainstream media and Israeli media as well, as they being the reason that Israel is bringing out its weapons and bombing Syria. Have these allies become some sort of a burden for Syria because they are here to help, because that's why Israel is bombing?
No, not at all. The only burden in the region is the Zionist enemy. That is the only burden in the region. As if Israel wasn't an aggressor before this war. As if Israel wasn't an aggressor before we strengthen our relation with Iran and before Hezbollah and Iran come to help Syria. Of course they will criticize, because this is against their agenda. The more we get together, the more angry they will feel. Now, I think the reason why the Zionist enemy and Western allies as well are very careful or very anxious about what's happening in the region is the plan to do a railway between Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. This, for them, is a great threat. They say because it carries arms to Hezbollah. It's not because of that. Because it's going to make the region flourishing region, because it's going to do great service to the people of the region. We have to agree that the ultimate aim of all these wars against us is to prevent us from developing, from prospering, from becoming a major player in the region. That is their aim. And therefore, really, we have to learn that whatever they say, you know, we have to interpret it, analyze it, edit it, and refuse most of it.
Well, that concludes our first segment, but brings us with a great push to our second segment of the show to talk about most pressuring issues happening right here inside Syria, where the Syrian civilians are feeling the most of it, which is the economic hardships, because the calamity to the Syrian economy for over 10 years of Takfiri terrorism, Western illegal unilateral punitive measures, they cannot be underestimated and they can be felt by the public. I mean, the heavy combat in Syria is probably over, the heavy bombardment campaigns. But the situation, it's becoming worse by the day economically, especially with the U.S. CSERS Act of 2019, the civilian, so-called Syrian Civilian Protection Act of 2019, and the U.S. looting more than $100 billion of Syrian oil and Syrian resources, where they are occupying land inside of Syria. And there might be some victories still going on the battlefield, and everyone recognizes them, but it's not really tangible to the citizens, but rather the losses are. In your views, how can Syria really survive this painful economic hardship?
Well, before answering this question, let me say something. Yeah. Yesterday, I was attending a lecture by Talal Abu Ghadale at Damascus University, and he said he was on the board of World Trade, International World Trade, and an important paragraph in that is that no country in the world has the right to impose sanction on any other country unilaterally without the approval either of the UN or the World Trade or without the approval of a body, an international body. And therefore, what the US called Syrian Protection Act, it is actually a criminal act. It's not a protection act. It's a criminal act against the Syrian people. And I see in it a continuation of the terrorist war against Syria, because they failed to make Syria succumb, as you said in your introduction. So they turned now first to occupying the land directly, to robbing our resources. And I don't know how any country can claim to be leading in the world and yet under daylight steals the resources of another people. I mean, this is moral bankruptcy for any country. And so they turned to economic sanctions, to what is called CSERS Act, in order to strangle the Syrian people. Of course, this is accompanied with the media you mentioned, whether pan-Arab media or Israeli media or Western media, against Russia, against Iran, against Syria, against the steadfastness, in order to make the Syrian people give up and say, okay, we can't do anything. Mm-hmm. But if they read history, they know that this is not the Syrian people who are going to do that. The Syrian people are going to soldier on with finding new ways of survival. Yesterday, our President Bashar al-Assad reopened the Center for Excellence in Homs. This was first opened in 2009. 2011, the terrorists destroyed it. That was one of the first targets. That proves that they don't want us to be excellent, to be achievers. They want us to be followers of what they want us to do. Mm-hmm. Syria was able first to make this center carry on in its teaching, in Latakia, in Damascus, everywhere, and now to rebuild this center. And yesterday, students went back to the center. Farmers went back to their lands. They are sowing, they are reaping, they are producing. We, perhaps, this huge problem is an opportunity for Syria to be totally self-reliant in everything it wants. And the Syrian people are so creative and so determined and so rooted that no one will be able to uproot them.
Mm-hmm. Does that simply mean that with Syria mending its ties with certain Arab states that were against Syria at one point but now seem to have taken a U-turn, does that new relationship mean they might be willing to fund improvements in economics and development, social development, economic development inside Syria?
Well, that is a political decision, and I don't know whether it's a totally political decision or whether it has to do with those parties who convinced them at the beginning to finance the war. You saw foreign ministers on TV saying that they put $37 billion to finance the war on Syria. So if they now don't, the war doesn't help Syria, it is, for me, understandable, because they didn't want Syria to survive anyway.
But they did open new doors of communication with Syria, for example, like the UAE.
There are new doors, but they haven't yet reached the point of becoming essential for rebuilding in Syria. Because, as I said, you know, we don't know who can and who cannot due to political circumstances and to political decisions. Syria is open, and Syria doesn't have a resentment. You know, even internally, President Bashar al-Assad started a reconciliation process many years ago, and it has got its fruition, really, in the country. And therefore, we look to the future. We are not people who work on resentment and who look into the past. What I mean is that, of course, after wars, countries will go back, will start relations, but on certain basis, on the basis of integrity, of dignity, and with full respect to those who sacrifice their lives in order to protect the independent decision of the country. Mm-hmm. That's most important.
And when you say that Syrians do not hold a grudge and do not resent, it's basically because of the bringing up. And bringing up means the role of women in the Syrian society. I mean, the global war in Syria had devastating impact on women. It also had shifted their roles in the workforce inside of Syria. But consequently, women are becoming increasingly influential in the public space in Syria and shaping Syria's future. I want to read an excerpt from your book, which I would love for you to sign for me when we finish our interview. But you say, "I believe it is time Arab women learn."
This book.
Yes, I will say exactly the title of the book, which is Both Right and Left-Handed by Dr. Buthaina Shaban. It's about stories of Arab women in our region. And in this book, you practically say that I believe it is time Arab women learned not to fight men's battles while losing out themselves. I think our priority as women should be to help spread a feminist consciousness in every domain and across all categories, social categories, in order to be prepared for these struggles to come. You wrote this in the Both Right and Left-Handed in 1988.
Yeah.
Were Syrian women ready for the tsunami wave that struck in 2011, as it still has shock waves and ripples affecting the ability to create maybe even new unthinkable challenges for these women?
I don't think anybody was ready for this tsunami. I think the whole so-called Arab Spring, which is an Arab disaster, took everybody by surprise. But we quickly adapted to the situation and started to deal with it. And I really believe at times of crisis, as at other times, peaceful times, women have an extremely fundamental role to play. And in this war, as you said, women are the ones who actually bring up their children, who are the ones who plant in their heads the importance of the country, the sacrifice for the country. I mean, if you see the Syrian woman whose sons would go to fight terrorists and that they would receive their bodies, first son and second son, and they would say, this is, you know, an honor for us because it is for the sake of the country. I mean, it takes really great bravery for a mother and great also belief, great faith in the country to be able to say that. Now, I wrote this book in the aftermath of the liberation also of Algeria. I made many interviews with Algerian women. And Algerian women said that we were fighting the political war, but without paying attention to our rights. And when the war was over, we did not get our rights. And what I meant is that during the war, when women are sacrificing and women are playing an important role in fighting this war, they should also think of their rights. The whole not only women, men also, should think of radicalizing the society, not just winning the war on the ground in the battlefield, but winning the social war, winning the economic war, winning the human war, winning the educational war. Therefore, that's what I mean, and I believe in that, really. I mean, I was a feminist, I'm still a feminist, but now I believe that I'm capable to fight not only for women, not only for Arab women and men, but for human being in general, everywhere. And therefore, there are basic rules that should apply that would make everybody happier. But I don't believe in Western feminism.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shaban, for your time and for your contribution to our show.
Thank you very much, Marwa, and all the power to you. I think the world needs you, not only Arab women. The world needs your voice.
I'm humbled by your words. Thank you very much. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood, and we are engaging in the discussion of the reasons the sociological, the socio-political, the economic, and the historic circumstances in which the prophets came. Like, what phenomenon in history, this issue of prophethood is a phenomenon in history, and what happened in history that this phenomenon came about and it got materialized in the society is what we are trying to address. And we reached this place where Imam Ali alayhi salam was saying one of the reasons why one of the situations in which the prophets came was that he says that وطرائق متشتتة بين مشبه لله بخلقه أو ملحد في اسمه أو مشير إلى غيره. That people at that time followed different paths. They had become various paths with regards to their belief in God. So some people were, giving a similarity between God and his creation. They were saying these are similar. And for example, and we gave those examples previously, of course. And the other thing that they used to do is that أو ملحدين في اسمه. They would be disbelievers, but in the name of God, rather because of, concentrating only in the name of God and not going further in forming that relationship with God himself, and diving, or you can say drowning, in that confusion.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, in the previous session, we talked about the fact that human beings, unfortunately, when they ended up, you know, thinking about God, rather when they, of course, naturally had this tendency to understand God and know God, at times they would only, delve on the discussion about what are the names of this God, what are the attributes of this God, and they would not go further than that in forming a relationship with God. So, you know, as you know, for example, there are people who believe that God for example, created the heavens and then the heavens, the earth, and then he stepped aside. So such people have given such an attribute, such a name to God, that the God that creates and goes. And this name, they made it in such a way, they postulated in their minds in such a way that now a human being doesn't have any relationship with God. He's a disbeliever, in other words. So the name, the delving and the discussion in the name of God is what is the actual reason for their disbelief. And we gave different examples in the previous sessions. Now, these types of, fitnas, these types of problems, these types of, deviations, and difficulties, problems are the ones that caused the society to be in such a situation that it necessitated the coming of prophets to come and kind of pave the way for the final purpose of human beings to be materialized. In the second sermon of Nahjul Balagha, Imam Ali alayhi salam explains this. He discusses about the circumstances at the times when the prophets came. How were the people at that time? He says, for example, in one of the sermons, he says, وَالنَّاسُ فِي فِتَنٍ إِنْ جَذَمَ فِيهَا حَبْلُ الدِّينِ وَتَزَعْزَعَتْ سَوَارِ الْيَقِينِ. He says that at that time, when the messengers came, when the prophets came, people were so much, encapsulated in different types of tribulations and fitnas and confusions.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the circumstances or the situation of the people at the time when the prophets came. One of them, in the second sermon, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَالنَّاسُ فِي فِتَنٍ إِنْ جَذَمَ فِيهَا حَبْلُ الدِّينِ. That people were, encapsulated in tribulations, in fitnas, in confusions, in such a manner that the rope of religion was cut off. The rope of religion was cut off. In other words, the people were not holding on to the religion. They had separated themselves from religion because of those confusions and those fitnas and those problems and tribulations that happened at that time, those tests and the occurrences of those times. وَتَزَعْزَعَتْ سَوَارِ الْيَقِينِ. And it was a time when the handles, or the handlebars, or the handles of certainty were weakened. You know, for example, when you want to stand up, when you're about to fall, when you want to stand somewhere, you hold a handle and you grasp it and then you stand and you hold yourself. Sometimes what happens is that these are weak. So when you go to hold them, you fall down. Or for example, they just break off. So at that time, the situation was such that people those handlebars or those handles that would keep someone on track, that would, for example, stop one to fall into misguidance and oblivion, those things had become very weak. In other words, people didn't have strong belief. They didn't have that strong faith in their hearts to be able to continue the path of religion. So we notice these problems at that time. And Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about this. And therefore, it is for us to contemplate and see, how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala out of His kindness came and saved the humanity from destruction through the messengers of God. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Cultivating an Islamic identity in a postmodern world has been our topic tonight. I want to look at the components of an Islamic identity. So my sisters and my brothers, the first component of the Islamic identity is to capture the I inside of us, the who-ness inside of us. Who are you is not answered by the color of your eyes or your height or where you were born even. Who you are your values, your morals, your ethics. That's why when you look at the revelation of the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Allahumma salli ala. He made it a point to introduce God in two ways. It's very important. Not only is He Rabbul Alameen, He's Rabbul Nas as well. I mentioned that point, I think, 2 nights ago here. The same God that's a God of the universe and the skies and the heavens is the same God that is of you and me as well. The revelation of the Quran wasn't this idea of the Prophet using the Quran to promote himself. Or it was all about praising God. No, it was very much man-centric, insan-centric, human-centric. All the verses, the ultimate purpose behind them was to gain man's salvation, was to make a woman now enter Jannah. It's an encompassing work of principles that involves, of course, your social life, your individual life, your ethics, your values, you name it. Every dimension of your I is covered inside the scripture as overall principles. And Islam says, constantly revisit the I. Why do you think we have hadiths like Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala? One hour of contemplation is equal to sometimes a lifetime of worship, he says. Contemplation. 1 hour is a long time. Try 5 minutes of it. Contemplation. Sit there in silence. Next time you drive alone in the car, no radio, no phone, just you and the sound of the road. If you last 10 minutes without freaking out, it's a big deal. We're afraid of ourselves. We're afraid what might come out. We're afraid what the thought might lead us towards. So like I said, we drown it. We blast the nohas, inshallah. Those halal qasidas, inshallah. We blast those, inshallah. Right? But just don't leave me alone with my thoughts. And when I am alone, I reach for my phone. Even in the wake up in the morning, I don't want that walk to the... Even in the bathroom, I don't want to be by myself, man. We're afraid of it. Islam says, no, embrace the I inside of you. Stop for a moment. Understand what's going on. This is who you are. And the more we capture it, the more that we capture it, the more we're in control. The biggest problem is that we've exported that to everybody else. We've asked people online, tell me how religious I am, how spiritual I am, how beautiful I am, how skinny I am, how great I am. You tell me and then I will believe it. One beautiful thing from this pandemic is it closed the outside world to us and forced us to look inward. It really did. It's a lot of my youth now. You guys give a lot of weight to what others say about you. And then you are convinced of it. That validation you give to others. You come and validate me. Why? Because we don't want to face the I. Why do you think sometimes this idea, and the way that death is, you know, described in the Quran and sometimes in our scriptures is beautiful. At one time it says it's what? Until you reach hatta ataka al-yaqeen. The veils are lifted. Death is the lifting of veils. Lifting of what veils? Our own veils. And sometimes the Quran refers to it as a mulaqat. فَإِنَّهُ مُلَاقِيكُمْ Surah Jum'ah. The very death that you farar from, run from, flee from, it's going to meet up with you. Take you back to the alim and the shahid. فَيُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ And give you khabar and tell you what you did wrong and what you did right. And as one alim had said in one of my classes, he said that the reason why sometimes we fear death, it's not my topic, don't worry, we fear death is because death is a meeting with yourself. In the grave, it'll be you, yourself, and I. No mother-in-law, no daughter-in-law. It was her, it was him, nobody. It's you and that's it. And all your masks are taken off. All of my masks are taken off. The cultivation of an Islamic identity starts with the I inside of me. And it is the harmonization of every life, of every path of mine to go through the I. The phrase La ilaha illallah is a very unique phrase that requires a breakdown. And if we break it down into half, before illa and after illa, the second half will not be possible until the first half is. True? This negation of the ilah inside of us, the small g gods as I call it, the small g, that has to happen first before the big g god enters our system. So the example I gave just was the idea of, and these things are incredible to me. There's a reason why sometimes the sunnah of the Holy Prophet is hujjat for us. There are some things that he does that are obvious that we should follow, right? Him being Amin, the way he is with orphans, how open he is with the youth. Those things are obvious. But then these small things that he would do that would kind of make you think that, wait a second, there's wisdom here. There's wisdom here. In the conquering of Mecca, two major things happened. In the 8th year of Hijri, one was the breaking of the idols around the Kaaba, inside the Kaaba. And the second was Bilal's Adhan. To me, at least, these things were huge. A lot of things happened, but these two things for me was huge. I want you to come with me as we look at the tartib and the sequence of how these two things happened. Okay? All in the name of La ilaha illallah, right? There is no God but God. Negation, 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 separation, separation, separation. What's left is, who should be left is God. And sometimes it's a lifelong process. This la ilaha goes on until the last day almost. Mecca is conquered. One of the first things that the Prophet says is destroy the idols. This is now an Islamic town. So he would, of course, summon his soldiers to go to this marketplace, to that marketplace. He would ask individuals if there are any idols in your homes, destroy those. And then quite poetically, of course, him and Imam Ali together destroyed the idols inside the Kaaba. After the destruction of the idols, then Bilal climbs the Kaaba and gives the adhan. The imagery is very important. He does not climb the Kaaba and on the Kaaba give that very, very famous adhan until the idols were all destroyed. Ali break the idols, Ali break the idols, Bilal up the Kaaba. Ali break the idols, Bilal up the Kaaba. La ilaha illallah. So many of our youth, me as well, all of you, I'm sure, we always sit there and say, look, I'm just not getting to God. I'm not getting to God. Wallahi, there is iman inside of me. I believe, but there seems to be barrier after barrier after barrier. I still, after all these years of living my life, I can't get up for Fajr for the life of me.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Yani?
Bazaar.
Many people have ideas. However, those who turn their ideas into reality are the ones who search for ways to make their ideas happen. More often than not, this occurs by joining knowledge with method. Knowledge brings competitive advantages and generates sustainable market leadership. Its tools are creativity and innovation, which are all intangible human talents. Never more than now has knowledge been so critical and significant in production and the shift towards a knowledge-based economy. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we are going to explore the central role science and technology parks play in complementing the knowledge-based production ecosystem. We wanted to see how the government is shifting towards a knowledge-based economy, and plus we wanted to understand why tech parks are so critical to industry development and the national economy. So let's get started. To better understand the country's knowledge-based ecosystem, we visited an event at Semnan Science and Technology Park where we could get some answers. Science and technology parks are where startups and innovative teams can operate in one geographical location. These areas provide diverse services and facilities to companies that fit the criteria. We were able to catch up with a couple companies that operate out of this park. One of these companies specializes in producing advanced machines used in mining. This company is one of only a handful that has managed to indigenize these previously imported products. Events like the one we visited helped braid together and link companies, investors, and infrastructures with the necessary resources to complete projects. These components all make up the various parts of the knowledge-based ecosystem. But we also wanted to know how science and tech parks operate and why they are attractive to businesses. One of the advantages of these parks is that it's a space where crucial resources are offered. These places are a focal point for serving knowledge-based companies producing advanced, specialized products needed in the domestic market. Science and technology parks also serve as a launching pad toward the international arena. We spoke with a park official who helped shed more light on this issue.
There are four scenarios of which foreign companies could have the opportunity to reside in Semnan Science and Technology Park. Well, the first scenario will be the execution of soft landing programs between the two countries, which gives the foreign companies an opportunity to get familiar with the host country's market. Well, the second scenario will be holding joint events, including joint startup events, fairs and similar events which could help them get familiar with each other. And the other scenario, or the third way that a company could have the chance to come to our park, will be to find and carry out joint projects with our companies, and finally sharing the interests. The fourth scenario will be holding joint innovation tours, which gives the companies an opportunity to get familiar with how innovation ideas are being implemented in other countries.
These parks are essential in filling a gap in the tech innovation ecosystem, providing monetary resources and attracting investments. These establishments also join investors with particular companies and projects. They offer numerous unique services such as facilitating visa processes, offering financial assistance such as soft loans, or even special incentives under free trade zones like tax exemptions. And it doesn't stop there. This park offers so much more to investors.
The other solution or the other way that could attract foreign investors will be to define BOT models, which means they have to introduce projects and within the framework of our protocols. And once it has been approved, they can operate the project for a while. This includes mainly long-term projects. Particularly, and I shall have to tell you that Semnon Science and Technology Park is very interested in projects in the fields of artificial intelligence, IT, ICT, IoT, and virtual reality. And we could help these companies. And once they have, once they build it and then operate it, they could transfer it to our park.
Most tech parks are active in the international sphere and collaborate with other domestic tech parks. Furthermore, these areas function as export hubs. Therefore, one of their main activities is boosting and supplying domestic products to this end.
Semnon Science and Technology Park has been very active in international arena. And our president, Dr. Nazari, has put a great focus in this part. And for information, I have to tell you that we have held two prestigious international events at our park. One in our park, last year we did it in March, I think, with the presence of some great companies, a Turkish delegation, some companies from Turkey. And before that, we held a joint event with Paris Technology Park, which was a technology investment meeting, which we had brought another Turkish delegation to that event, and it was one of the first collaborations between science and technology parks of Iran with Paris Technology Park in such a big international event.
Over the years, the government has placed special attention on knowledge-based companies while implementing new approaches to support tech parks and their businesses. Some of these initiatives aim to remove obstacles along the path of development of these companies. Other activities involve giving resources to executive branches to further develop the ecosystem of innovation and technology nationwide. Along these lines, the Vice Presidency for Science and Technology has implemented a series of activities. This includes investing some $1.4 billion towards financial services. The government has also created a strategic technology development headquarters. It is tasked with implementing 400,000 tech projects and 150 commercialization projects. But that's not all. The government has also established 65 innovation centers and dozens more accelerators to support the developing entrepreneurship ecosystem. Currently, there are well over 7,000 knowledge-based companies scattered across the nation. These enterprises offer services and products in numerous industries. Many are active in biotech, computer software, agriculture, food, chemical tech, aircraft maintenance, steel, gas, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals, just to name a few. According to government figures, the knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. Moreover, the share of knowledge firms in the country's GDP in 2019 exceeded $34 billion and witnessed a 450% growth since then. That's all according to the Vice President for Science and Technology. All right, now it's time for me to take a little break here and hand it over to my good friend out in the field who's prepared a report for us.
In ancient Iran, felt was already used in the production of numerous kinds of clothing, bed clothes, floor carpets, and different kinds of sacks. In fact, the Iranian world may have been an important center for the development of felt technology. In in the modern world today, felt or nomad has found its way to industries of all kinds in various forms.
You just can't imagine how crowded this place is. Whenever I want to talk on the phone, I have to find a sign-up place to be able to talk to you. It's really crazy. God, in today's chaotic society, stress is an issue that many of us suffer from every day. But what matters most is trying to find distress sources and try to find effective solutions. For this reason, today I'm here to tell you that I finally found a startup, a new innovative company that has finally found a solution to this disastrous problem. I won't tell you any further. Let's just go and check it out.
Felt, or so-called nomad, is the acoustic solution for rowdy places to absorb and decrease undesirable noises. The aim is to provide sound serenity and to improve physical, mental, and psychological health. Nomad Studio's scope of work is based on designing and manufacturing products. Recently, it has also played a significant role in different projects like some innovation centers in Asia and Africa. This company has focused on designing and building acoustic products. Generally in Iran, there is no specific competitor in this field. However, there are some groups in America and Northern Europe that are engaged with felt.
If I want to tell you about a history about how our company established, it goes back to 3 years ago when Diva was chosen to renovate the innovation factory of Iran, that was the biggest one in the time. And the designer tried to make the offices and they tried to design a place that the people be comfortable, have a good place to work. That's why we understand that we have some advantages and disadvantages. One of these disadvantages is about the sound pollution that we had in the this area, that places were noisy and the employees didn't like that. That's why we try to use special materials for control this sound pollution. And we reach the felt material and we try to use this material.
Designing acoustic and movable working stations with the aim of recycling old products and reuse them in different functions. What is worth noticing about this business is the fact that the problem-solution method is based upon three WH questions: why, how, and what. Why is to define the problem, how is the process towards the solution, and what is the final product and prototype. These acoustic solutions were combined with architecture in various parts of the space and played the role in sound insulation and creating a silent space.
All right, now I want to walk you through some of the major products that are made of felt. The first piece we have here is an artwork that is made of wool felt that acts as a sound-absorbing material, not only as an aesthetic material that you can put it in your home place, but also as a sound-absorbing material. There is the phone booth. If I get inside, I can feel the private space and how the atmosphere really changes. It improves the acoustic vibes and reduces the reverberation when I get inside. And there's this whole thing, we call it desk divider. It's actually one of the main products in this company. People and employees put it in on their desk to divide their own workplace with the person right next to them.
We have three different kind of material that we use on our works that absorb undesirable sounds, which are wool panels, or the other name is felt, and in Persian we say namat, and thermofelt and carpet.
and the felt are in two kind of industrial felt and the natural felt. Natural felt is made by wools, and industrial material is made by a process by the battles and pet materials. They have different color patterns and thicknesses. The thicknesses are from 3 millimeter to 50 millimeter. And about the thermofelt, we have this material that we can use for more absorption. It has three kind of material with polyester, jeans, and heavy traffic, and it's very good for absorbing. And the last one is the carpet that is heavy traffic that we use in heavy traffic places such as the offices, and it can be cleaned very easy by the vacuum cleaner.
As I mentioned earlier, this idea was created based on the concept of recreating, recycling, and revitalizing the surrounding substances and generalizing this idea to the upcoming products with different potentials. Such small-scale products are intended to improve the mental and physical health of users. And finally, creating a comfortable, inviting atmosphere.
Almost everything here is made of felt. Based on environmental psychology, the linear lighting has been created in a way to provide maximum visual and acoustic comfort in the workplace, especially a co-working space like this. This company, Namad Startup, has been trying to promote sustainability and also take steps towards industrialization. Among all the products here, there were so many things, but I decided to choose this felt laptop case to carry my laptop with me wherever I go. So as you could see, it's not about the ideas, it's about making the ideas happen.
There is so much more that can be said about the country's knowledge-based production and activities, so before we go, let's look at a couple of developments in this area. Most of us are familiar with vitamin supplements. However, some vitamins need to be injected, which can be a hassle. Now, a knowledge-based company has produced an oral form of one of these vitamins, saving many of us from the pain of sticking needles. This pharmaceutical company has produced the first oral form of a vitamin B complex that was typically only found in an injectable form. This company also operates out of Pardis Science and Technology Park. It is also one of the first and largest knowledge-based companies. It might be interesting to know that this company mainly produces raw materials such as probiotic products needed in the pharma industry. Such productions have saved the country millions on imports so far. Knowledge-based productions are driven by scientific discoveries, and Iranian scientists produce roughly 2% of the world's scientific articles. That's according to the Minister of Science, Research and Technology. Mohammad Ali Zulfigol says Iran, on average, registers around 70,000 scientific articles in international journals each year. He says Iran is now globally ranked 15th for the number of scientific papers it produces. Zulfigol noted the quality ranking of Iranian articles in the top 10 fields like technology and engineering. The minister highlighted that the nation ranks 5th in nanotechnology publications as well. The official further added that those publishing academic articles also work in knowledge-based companies, helping produce quality products in the competitive field. And with that, we come to the end of this segment. You can contact us with your thoughts and comments via email. And don't forget, you can also send us topics you're interested in. Thank you for tuning in, and join us next week, same time, for another edition of Bazaar. It's bye for now. Until then.